For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
My name's Kate Mizell. I'm on staff here at Xenos. I teach classes here and help oversee some of the home churches and high school student and adult ministry. I've been on staff here for about, 4 or 5 years maybe. I went to Ohio State, graduated with a degree in microbiology, and was planning on pursuing a degree in medicine until God called me into ministry. So this is an area that I really enjoy, even though I'm not a scientist. This is an area that I've really enjoyed studying, and this has been a big question for me. Does science contradict Christianity? How do these things harmonize? Can they harmonize? And so this is what we're going to be getting into kind of this afternoon. All right, so let's talk about what critics are kind of saying about this. Michael Onfray, an atheist philosopher, says God puts to death everything that stands up to him, beginning with reason, intelligence, and the critical mind. Peter Atkins, we've been quoting him a lot, right? He's an atheist chemist. He says science and religion cannot be reconciled, and humanity should begin to appreciate the power of its child, science. He says, and to beat off all attempts to compromise. Religion has failed, and its failures should stand exposed. Stephen Hawking says, before we understand science, it's natural to believe that God created the universe. But now science offers a more convincing explanation. And so what is Stephen Hawking saying right there? He's saying you must choose between science and God. You can't have both, right? But this is really far too simplistic, you know, of a conclusion that these guys are coming to, right? Because when you look at history, there's been brilliant scientists that are theists, and there's been brilliant scientists that are atheists, right, that are naturalists or materialists, meaning they don't believe in a God. They only believe that everything that's in the natural world, right, matter and chance, that's all there is. And yet there's been brilliant scientists really in both camps. And so really this question is not science versus God, but really we're dealing with a question of a battle of worldviews, right? Theism versus atheism, naturalism versus theism, right? This is really what we're talking about here. This is what's happening. And so what we're going to be talking about is really two different questions. First, can I believe in both science and God? And we're going to talk about a few points about that. And secondly, then, where does the evidence lead us? When we look at science, right, and that's a huge topic, so we're going to be talking about just a few things really quick, right, where does the scientific evidence kind of point us then when we start examining things? And we'll go through 7 different kind of lines of reasoning in regards to that. And so let's start with this first question. Can I believe in both science and God? And really, as we're answering this question, we're going to be talking more so about really the philosophy of science and kind of the history of science to answer this question here. So let's kind of investigate the current debates about this issue. Firstly, let's talk about the history of science. Where does modern science really come from? When you examine history, lots of top scientists have been believers in God, like I mentioned before. Galileo, Kepler, Pascal, Isaac Newton, Louis Pasteur, all of these guys were theists. They all believed in God and are some of the most brilliant scientists that have ever lived. In fact, the biblical worldview was intimately involved in the rise of modern science in the 16th and 17th centuries. Right? That's really what we would call the rise of modern science was during those 2 centuries. And a lot of these guys, right, that were big during this time believed in a creator. And the reason why this is, I like the way that C.S. Lewis puts it. He says the reason why is because they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver, right? They knew, reading the Bible, that this is a God who gives laws, right? This is a God who lays out his ideas, his rules, and so they expected we're going to see that in nature too because they believed in a God. This is depicted in Jeremiah 33. It says, but this is what the Lord says. I would no more reject my people than I would change my laws that govern night and day, earth and sky. And so this is what these scientists are reading, right? They have this biblical worldview that God is a God who has laws, right? Including in nature. And so they expected that, right? They went out to go see and discover what those laws are that really govern nature. And so Lots of these guys had this perspective. And so when you think about some of the most brilliant scientists, right, take Isaac Newton, right, discover the law of gravity. He discovered the law of gravity, and yet he was a believer in God. Stephen Hawking, on the other hand, he considers the law of gravity, and really kind of the central argument in his book, The Grand Design, is that the law of gravity demonstrates to us that God doesn't exist, right? How do these two guys come to such different conclusions, right? Why does Stephen Hawking say we have to choose, right, between believing in the law of gravity and believing in God? So secondly, I think we need to consider the nature of explanation. And the first thing I want to talk about is this idea of scientism, because there's big problems with this view. Scientism is really the belief or the statement that only science can lead to truth. Peter Adkins says, there is no reason to suppose that science cannot deal with every aspect of existence. His perspective, right, he's really expounding this idea of scientism, that only science can tell me what is true. Nothing else. Now, it doesn't take much time to think about some of the problems with this, right, and some of the implications of this. First off, right, it's a self-contradictory statement. Science is the only thing that can lead me to truth. Is not a scientific statement, right? That is outside the realm of science, right? That's really meta-scientific. It's talking about science. It's not a scientific statement, right? And so it's a self-contradictory idea. Secondly, science has a scope, but it also has limits, right? And it has explanatory limits of what it can explain and what it can't explain. And we've talked about this a little bit in different plenary sessions, but very quickly, I think you can probably imagine, you know, is there any questions in my life that science can't answer for me? Of course there are, right? Why am I here, right? What's my purpose? What about issues of morality? Right? Science cannot answer these questions. It cannot provide answers to everything. Right? Science is a great tool for finding out what is true about the natural universe. Science uncovers, right, how things work in the natural world. But there's a lot of things that science cannot explain. Right? And not every statement by a scientist is a statement of science. And that's what we start to see with a lot of these statements from these guys, right, is that they're not talking about science anymore. They've really entered into like a meta-scientific discussion. So take, for example, okay, here you have a kettle boiling, right? There's water boiling in this kettle. I might, you know, maybe you'd come up to me and you say, Kate, why is the kettle boiling? Why is the water boiling? You know, and I could correctly answer and say, well, you know, heat energy from the flame, you know, is being conducted through the base of the kettle, which is agitating the water molecules, you know, as they're heating up, they're moving faster, turning into water vapor, and the water's boiling. And that would be an answer, right? That would be a correct answer. Now, it would be very silly if I came back and said, no, that's not why the water's boiling. The water's boiling because I want a cup of tea. You'd be like, that's ridiculous, right? That's ridiculous if I said, no, right, it's not heat energy that's causing the water molecules, you know, to move quicker and to turn into water vapor. It's because I want a cup of tea, right? That would be completely crazy. That's a crazy statement. These are two different levels of explanation that we're talking about here, right? Two different levels. There's a scientific explanation versus a personal agency explanation. And so these two statements don't conflict or contradict with each other. In fact, they complement each other, right? Both of those things are true. The scientific explanation, right, involves heat energy, right, and their relationship to the water molecules. The agency explanation is that I put the kettle on the heat because I want a cup of tea. And so we would never say that the scientific explanation, right, conflicts here. They're not the same type or kind of explanation. And so the question then is God the same kind of explanation as a scientific explanation, right? Agency versus the mechanism. Are they the same type of explanation? And this, is, I think, is an area that we need to watch out for, right? Watch out for false choices that people give you of making you choose between the mechanism and the agent, right? Two different types of explanation. And so let's talk about the nature of God then, right, as we're thinking about this question. You know, for some, the success of science has led to the idea that we no longer need a God, right? God is no longer necessary because we can conclude and understand things without him being part of the picture. In fact, many atheists say, right, that Christians believe in this idea of the God of the gaps. And when I talk about the God of the gaps, what that means is I can't explain X, therefore God did it. And there's big problems if that is the type of God that we're adopting, right? There's big problems with that. For instance, okay, people used to believe in a God of lightning, right? And so God, you know, was up in heaven, and when he would get angry, he would stomp around, and that would cause thunder, and he'd throw lightning bolts to earth, right? Now, right, we can study atmospheric physics, and we know, okay, that's not what happens, right? We understand weather, we understand atmospheric physics. There is no God of lightning. And so, do you see what the problem is? If we adopt this position that, you know, if I can't explain X, God did it, then by definition, we have to choose between science and God. Because as soon as we have a scientific explanation, God is no longer necessary. There is no God of lightning because we can explain it through science, right? And so there's big problems if we adopt this idea. We cannot argue with a perspective of having this God of the gaps, because the God of the gaps is dispelled by science. You have to choose then between science and God. But the God of the Bible is not a God of the gaps at all, right? He's the God of the whole show, right? He's the God of what we can understand and of what we can't understand. You know, go back to Isaac Newton, right? Isaac Newton discovers the law of gravity, and he didn't say, awesome, I don't need to believe in God anymore. No. Isaac Newton discovered the law of gravity and went, awesome. He wrote the Principia Mathematica to persuade people that this should make them believe in a God, believe in a creator, right? The more he understood about the world, the more he appreciated the creator. It didn't change his perspective, right, about science. He thought, this is awesome. It tells me more about the God that's behind it. Richard Swinburne says, no, I am not postulating a God of the gaps, a God merely to explain the things that science has not yet explained. I am postulating a God to explain why science explains. I don't deny that science explains, but I postulate God to explain why it explains. The very success of science in showing us how deeply ordered the natural world is provides strong grounds for believing that there is an even deeper cause for that order. Right? And so this is not a God of the gaps that we're talking about when we talk about the God of the Bible. Right? What he's saying is, okay, so say that you go to the Louvre, right, and you're on a nice Parisian vacation, you know, and you're exploring through there, and the more that you study and understand art, right, you're looking at beautiful artwork by Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, right, the more you study and understand that art, the more you're going to appreciate the artist, right, the more you're going to appreciate da Vinci, Michelangelo. And in the same way, this is what he's saying, right? The more that we understand about the world through science, the more we can appreciate God, right? We need God to even explain to us why science tells us anything. And we'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later on here. But what we're saying is that God is the God of the things I do understand and what I don't understand. Because the God of the Bible, think about his qualities, right? This is not an exhaustive list. But the God of the Bible is eternal, right? He's self-existent. He's infinite, he's non-material, and he's all-powerful. And so when I talk about God, this is the God that I'm talking about. This is the God that the Bible is talking about. But a lot of the times in conversations, everyone has very different definitions of God, right? And so we shouldn't assume that everybody is operating out of this definition. I think that's important that we should take away, right? This is the God that we need in order to not have a God of the gaps. And so God is a completely different kind of explanation than a scientific explanation. I really like John Lennox. He says, God created the universe does not conflict any more than the statement, Henry Ford created the motor car, conflicts with the law of internal combustion. Right? See, there's so many scientific laws, there's so much science that's happening within a car, right? But that does not eliminate the necessity of a creator. It doesn't eliminate the necessity of an agent behind the creation of that car. And so these things really complement each other. They don't contradict each other. And so when we think back to this question, right, can I believe in both science and God? Absolutely yes. And so the next question that we need to be thinking of then is, where does scientific evidence really point us then? Anthony Flew talks about this really in connection with his turn from atheism to deism, right? He started being like, oh, there has to be a God. He says, my whole life has been guided by the principle, right, of Plato's Socrates. He says, follow the evidence wherever it leads. And he goes on, he says, even if we don't like where it leads us. And so we should follow where it's leading us. What does science tell us about the world? Well, first point on here, we're gonna go through seven. And this is a bird's eye view, right? We could do a whole talk on each one of these. And we've got a whole talk on a couple of these, so we're gonna speed through a lot of them. But the first point here is the rational intelligibility of the universe. What I mean by this, right? This means that nature is rational and that it's orderly such that it can actually be comprehended by humanity. You know, that it's ordered, it can be understood. Albert Einstein says the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible, that we can actually study it, that we can actually understand it, right? And the very concept of the intelligibility of the universe actually presupposes the existence of rationality capable of recognizing that intelligibility. And we're going to talk about this a little bit later too, but the bottom line is, right, it means that when we go out and study the world, it's presupposing that I can have confidence that it can be understood, and I have confidence that my brain is even able to tell me that this is true, what I'm studying, right? That my brain can even understand or tell me something that's true about the world. On the other hand, naturalism offers no such basis for this, right? Under naturalism, the system operates out of complete randomness and blind chance, right? That's not orderly, right? It's random. And so we're going to get into this a little bit later too. But like I mentioned earlier, right, faith in God, far from hindering science, has actually driven science forward. Because belief in God as a rational intelligence behind the universe allows us to trust in the uniformity and consistency in nature in order to even study it, right? In order to have consistent results when we study nature, we have to believe that nature has some sort of consistency behind it, right? That we can understand what laws are, because these laws are going to act in a consistent way, right? And we have that as a presupposition whenever we come in to do any sort of study about the world. Second point, the existence of the universe, right? Why is there a universe at all instead of absolutely nothing? And last night, right, we talked about how people like to redefine nothing, right? But this is a big question. Why is there something rather than nothing? A lot of people, a lot of atheists will try to kind of put forth this idea that, well, there is something because of the laws of nature. The laws of nature have brought things into existence. But that can't be the case. And yet this is what we see. Paul Davies, he says, I have never liked the idea of divine tinkering. For me, it is much more inspiring to believe that a set of mathematical laws can be so clever as to bring all these things into being. Right? He's not hiding what his worldview is, right? And I like this quote because it also shows us everybody has a bias, right? It's not that, oh, the theist is coming in with all their God biases in science, right? But here, he's not just saying, I don't believe in a God. He says, I've never liked it. He goes on and he talks about this in other places. He says, I don't want there to be a God, right? And so we've all got biases coming in. But see what he's saying here? He's like, I think it's way more inspiring to believe that laws, right, mathematical laws could bring something into existence, you know, can create something. And so the question is, can a theory or law create something? Can a theory or law bring something into existence here? And so let's think for a minute kind of about the laws of nature and kind of the status of the laws of nature. Laws, right, they describe what happens. Think, for instance, of a baseball player, right? The laws of motion can describe motion, right? That's what they do. They tell us what's happening as the pitcher releases the ball. And then as soon as the batter hits the ball, they can explain everything that's happening in the change of direction and the change of energy and the energy transfer that's happening here, right? But the baseball is not caused to move by the laws of motion. All they do is explain what's happening. It's not causing the ball to move, right? And so the laws are only describing this. And so laws do not cause anything or bring anything into existence. And this idea is actually really strange when you start to think about it, right? Let's think about, okay, the motor car, right? We said there's lots of laws working within a car, right? But those laws don't necessitate that car being made, right? They just describe what's happening. Or think about a simple math equation, right? 1 + 1 = 2. That's a law, right? Those are laws of arithmetic. But 1 + 1 = 2 has never given me $2 extra, right? Or 2 extra fries when I'm finished with my meal, right? It doesn't bring anything into existence. All it does is tell me something, right? And so laws cannot cause something to come into existence. And so I think there's a lot of confusion as to the status of laws, right? It's not causative. It's not creative. The sun rises from the east and sets in the west, right? That's a law. And yet the law did not create the sun, right? It didn't create the east. It didn't create the west, right? And so laws and theories don't bring anything into existence. There needs to be a cause. Thirdly, the beginning of the universe, right? In 1929, Hubble discovered that the universe was expanding, pointing to the fact that it had some sort of beginning for time and space. And we talked about this a lot last night. So I won't belabor this, but most scientists, not all, but most scientists hold to this idea of the Big Bang, right? That this was the origin of the universe, started at the Big Bang, at this singularity. John Barrow and Frank Tipler said, at the singularity, space and time came into existence. Literally nothing, and they mean nothing, right? Not a little bit of something. Literally nothing existed before the singularity. So if the universe originated at such a singularity, we would truly have a creation ex nihilo, which just means out of nothing. And what's amazing is that's exactly what we see described in the Bible. And yet it's interesting because when you look at history, particularly the history of the Big Bang theory, it was rejected for a long time on that basis. Many naturalist scientists initially rejected this theory because it sounded too much like the Bible, right? You think about Genesis 1:1, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? That God spoke everything into existence out of nothing. Hebrews 11:3, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. It was actually made out of nothing, right? By a God who is able to speak it into existence. Stephen Hawking says, many people don't like the idea that time has a beginning, probably because it smacks of divine intervention, right? And so, certainly, Christians have been guilty over the years of suppressing, right, scientific truth. But it's not just Christians, right? It's the atheists as well. Many people push this theory down. This theory was around way long time ago. I think the first time it came up was like in the 40s, right? And people really didn't discuss this for a while because it sounded way too much like Genesis 1. And so, well, we need to realize it was rejected not on scientific evidence, right? But it was rejected on the basis of naturalism, on a worldview, not on evidence here. And so really on this, right, the Bible's been way ahead of science for a long time. You know, the Hebrew people way back in the day, you know, could have explained to you, yeah, time had a beginning, right? The universe came from nothing, right? Way ahead of where science has been. Fourthly, the fine-tuning of the universe. Right? The universe is governed by physical constants. So many, right? If you memorize them all from Wallace's talk this morning, right? There's a strong nuclear force. There's a gravitational constant. There's a cosmological constant. There's all these different types of constants that are really governing our universe. And what we see when we study them is that these constants are at the exact value needed for life to exist, and are not determined by the laws of nature. They're basically preset dials that allow the universe to come into existence in the way that it is. And so if we change any one of them, the universe would become completely hostile to life forming. So take, for instance, gravity, right? The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant, which is this nice number right here. Okay, if this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th, no life would exist, right? If we changed it by just 1 in 10 to the 60th, right? He went through those numbers this morning. Think about your body. There are 10 to the 40th cells in your body, right? This number is way bigger than that. Right? And if it varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th, either the universe would have expanded way too rapidly and no stars would have been able to form, or it would have expanded way too slowly and collapsed back in on itself, meaning no stars, no life, no planets, nothing. Right? And so this is just one of these constants that we're talking about here. And so it's this kind of fine-tuning that then merits an explanation about this. Actually, after discovering one of these constants, Fred Hoyle, he's a physicist, an atheist. In fact, he's one of the guys who rejected the idea of the Big Bang, because he was like, sounds like God. I don't like this theory. After discovering one of these constants, he was really shaken by this. His atheism was like shaken up, because he was like, man, this is so specific. And that's just finding one of them. He says this. He says, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics and that there are no blind forces in nature. He's an atheist, a staunch atheist, right? And he's like, man, but it just seems like this like super intellect, right, has really tinkered with the universe and kind of set all this in motion, that it's not blind, but in fact, there's an intelligence behind it. And so chance cannot explain this level of fine-tuning. Paul Davy says, the impression of design is overwhelming. And this really is the conclusion that we come to with the fine-tuning argument, is that the impression of design is overwhelming, right? And, you know, this, the main kind of response to this from the naturalist is, well, what about the multiverse? What if there's just tons of different universes, and so the chance doesn't really matter because it was bound to happen in some sort of universe, right? The problem with that, one, is that we have to recognize when we start talking about the multiverse, we are no longer talking about science, right? We've moved past science into really talking about meta-science, really philosophy, because there's absolutely no scientific empirical evidence for a multiverse, right? And so we have to recognize and level with people, okay, that's fine that that's your theory, but you have to realize we're no longer talking about science. We're talking about philosophy at this point. And I think, like was mentioned this morning, all we're doing is pushing the problem back one step. It doesn't really change this argument for us, right? Because who created this multiverse generator, right? How did it get here? And if that is able to pump out all these amazing universes, that is surely more finely tuned than even our universe. And so there's big problems here. And so what's awesome about this fine-tuning of the universe is that atheists or theistic physicists alike agree on these numbers, right? And they agree on the chances. All people disagree about is the interpretation of them. And so some people disagree about how many there are, right? There's probably between 30 and 50 of these constants. We looked at one and the astronomically small chances of that happening, right? Now we're kind of compounding this with 30 to 50 other of these with just about similar tiny, tiny numbers. This comes from a book called The Privileged Planet by Guillermo Gonzalez and Jay Richards. They say, perhaps we have been staring past a cosmic signal more significant than any mere sequence of numbers. A signal revealing a universe so skillfully crafted for life and discovery that it seems to whisper of an extraterrestrial intelligence, immeasurably more vast, more ancient, and more magnificent than anything we've been willing to expect or imagine. Right? More ancient, right? What are we missing when we look out? What should this be showing us? That there's some sort of intelligence that's way older than the observable universe. And this is exactly what Scripture tells us about who God is, right? Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. In Romans 1, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So this backs up what these guys are saying, right? Are we missing a signal when people look out at the universe? Right? Are we missing a signal that should point us to God? Because what God is saying right here in Scripture is that when we look at the world, when we look at the universe, it should show us something about God and his power, right, and his characteristics. And so really up until this point, with points 1 through 4, we've really only been talking about physics, right, and cosmology. And so the next kind of 3 points or so that we're going to talk through is really in the realm of biology. And so what we need to think about is, if naturalism is true, right, if all that's in the world is matter and chance, then life must appear and progress by purely natural processes, nothing else. And so let's talk about the first one, how life works. All right, obviously there's whole degrees on this, so we're going to be touching on some basics here, right? But life is really what distinguishes plants and animals from inorganic matter like rocks, right? And really, for life to be life, it needs the capacity to maintain itself, right, to grow in some sense, and to reproduce. And so when we talk about the smallest unit of life, we're talking about a cell. So here's a nice picture of a eukaryotic cell. And in a cell, right, they're extremely complex. Each cell requires millions of proteins that come together to form these organelles, right? And these organelles are all these different molecular machinery that are inside a cell. You know, like your mitochondria and your ribosomes, right, the nucleus. All of these are different organelles that have different functions within the cell. And so all of these pieces are needed in every living cell. Now, there's a couple different kinds of cells, right? But generally, it's the same, right? All of this machinery is needed for a cell to function. And the problem is, too, all of these things must be in the cell all at the same time in order for the cell to function, right? They all have to be present at once. And so really, this brings up the issue of irreducible complexity. Right, that really a cell is a single system composed of several different interacting parts that contribute to its basic function. And if you take one of those things away, removing any of these parts effectively shuts down the function of the cell. It's no longer a functioning living cell. And what we know is that there's really absolutely no empirical evidence for molecular evolution. And when I talk about molecular evolution, right, it's really the evolving of these different machinery from simpler things, right? Or that some of these, you know, one of them could have been there, and then, you know, maybe it was originally just, you know, the ribosome, and then another one came in, right? There's no empirical evidence for that at all. All of these things have to be here and function together for a living cell to exist. And so inside a very special part, right, the nucleus, inside the nucleus, there's what's called DNA, right? DNA really directs life, and we're going to talk about DNA a little bit more, but really I call it kind of the manual for life, all the instructions about how to make these proteins that make up these organelles, right, how to reproduce. All of that is contained within DNA. And so it's really responsible for the maintenance of the cell, and it's also responsible for bringing up these proteins, right, through a process called translation. That is such a simplified version of this, right, because it's not just, oh, DNA, you know, turns to RNA, turns to protein. There's so many other things that actually happen, you know, that I'm not going to get into. I'm going to use some self-control because it's very exciting. But it's just such a simplified version of this, right? And yet this is how life works. And so the DNA, right, turns to proteins, which make up these molecular machines, right? These are all made of proteins. And proteins are made up of amino acids. There's 20 different amino acids, and all proteins are really made up of these amino acids. And yet it's not just that the building blocks, you know, are necessary for these to exist, but really they have to be in the exact right order for a functioning protein to even be made, right? And so here's kind of an example of this happens, of how this happens, right? You've got your amino acids, they form peptide bonds and form a peptide chain, and this folds over basically in four different ways to create a protein, right? A functioning protein. And so, again, kind of thinking from the naturalistic point of view, right? If these machines are really just random, unguided processes, then it's just purely left up to chance for these proteins to be made, right? And chance is not a sufficient explanation for this at all. And so let's kind of consider the chances of this happening. And we're going to consider this for a very, very tiny protein. We'll say 100 amino acids long. Most proteins are way bigger than this. So we've got our 20 amino acids. And so what are the chances, right, of getting the correct amino acid at a specific site in a 100 amino acid change, right? 1 in 20 to get an amino acid at the correct site, right? And so the probability of getting 100 of them right, right, in a chain of 100 amino acids would be 1 in 20 to the 100th, right, which really is just 1 in 10 to the 130th, right? What did we talk about with the gravitational constant? If it was off by 1 in 10 to the 60th, this is way bigger than that. Right, the chances of this are so much smaller even from this. That's why I really like calling this the fine-tuning of the cell, right? How ridiculously small the chances are of a really small protein just happening to get in the right order, right? Even if all the amino acids were there, right? And they all happen to be there. Not to mention the fact that this is even a simple, right, a very simplistic perspective about this, because most amino acids exist in like two forms, and almost all proteins only have one form of amino acids. And so your chances get even smaller here. And this is for a single tiny protein, right? Life as we know it requires hundreds of thousands of different proteins. The odds of producing this, one scientist calculated it, is 1 in 10 to the 40,000th, right? Sir Fred Hoyle, right, the atheist, he compares this, basically he says, man, the chances of this happening, right, is like a tornado sweeping through a junkyard and out comes a fully functioning 747 Boeing jet, right? This would never happen. And he gives this example, right? This is ridiculous. This is the chances that we're talking about of this happening spontaneously, randomly. And so not only this, but there's also big thermodynamic issues with this too, right? We talked about the second law of thermodynamics a little bit last night or this morning, I can't remember. Right, but it states that a system tends towards maximum entropy or maximum disorder or chaos, right? That cars rust, we age, right? It's not that things become more orderly, right, or more complex. It's really everything degenerates. Things lose order naturally, even when energy is put into it. And so it really stacks the odds completely against random shuffling producing some sort of highly ordered end product. And with a protein, when we talk about the formation of peptide bonds, what scientists call this is really an uphill reaction. That thermodynamically, it's not favorable. It takes a lot for this to even happen. I like the example that someone gave, right? This would be like throwing a stick of dynamite under a pile of bricks and popping out a beautiful house, right? That doesn't happen. You throw energy into a pile of bricks, it's going to become more disorderly, right? Not more orderly. And so this is a huge problem for the idea of formation of proteins. And so this is still a problem, and what we see in the functioning of the cell is that the thing that really helps to overcome this issue is the addition of more proteins called enzymes. But if we don't have proteins and we're forming a protein, how are we going to surpass this, right? We need the protein in order to even make a protein. So that's how life works in a nutshell. So let's talk about the origin of life, right? Based off of some of these issues about how life works, we naturally come to ask the question then of how did DNA, proteins, and cells just pop into existence, right? How did they get here? And so on top of the astronomically low chances given above about, you know, the formation of proteins from random chance, there's also these issues of the origin of life. There have been no successful experiments, scientific experiments, demonstrating spontaneous generation, Ernst Mayr, he's an atheist, he's an evolutionary biologist. He says, in spite of all the theoretical advances that have been made towards solving the problem of the origin of life, the cold fact remains that no one has so far succeeded in creating life in a laboratory. And there's been lots of studies done like this. Unfortunately, there's still studies that are cited that are total crap, you know, about this and that have been totally debunked. But the reality is we have never created even a single cell from scratch with the agent, with the scientist doing it, right? We've never been able to do that, and we have no idea how or if it can even be done. The other issue, right, irreducible complexity poses problems here for molecular evolution, like I mentioned before, right? This emergence of a living cell from non-living material. Looking at a cell, right, we said all these things need to be present at the same time. And when we talk about DNA becoming protein, right, DNA and proteins need to be present at the same time for DNA to even become a protein. Right, that's what all the molecular machinery in the cell is used for. Ribosomes, for example, are a huge part in translating, right, the RNA into a protein, into a chain of amino acids. A ribosome is a bunch of proteins together. Right, and so how do I make a protein just from DNA without any other proteins? You can't. There's big problems with this. And so evolution is an impossible solution for this. Evolution requires life in order to even do this. Charles Darwin, he recognizes this problem. He says, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. And this is what we see. We have no evidence for molecular evolution here. We need both of these things at the same time. And so it's kind of like the molecular chicken or an egg problem, right? Which came first? We need both things in this instance. Eugene Koonin, another evolutionary biologist who's an atheist, he says the origin of life field is a failure. We still do not have even a plausible, coherent model, let alone a validated scenario for the emergence of life on Earth. Through the multiplication of probabilities, these make the final outcome seem almost like a miracle, right? That it's miraculous, right, that life is here and that life has come into this world. And there's no good answer for this. And our last point here is about the genetic code and information. Okay, so life contains information. DNA really is chemical information within the cell. And information is not a physical or material thing, and we're going to be kind of discussing this, right? So let's think about this. Let's escape our classroom and imagine that instead of sitting here sweaty and exhausted, you're on a beach and you're walking, right? And all of a sudden you come along this and you see this sign that says help, right? Your first thought is knowing, okay, this is an important message and there's an intelligence that has been here, right? And is communicating something to me. And so this four-letter word has meaning. It communicates something, and it tells us there's an intelligence that has recently been on this beach. And yet, when we look at DNA, really what we've discovered is a 3.5 billion-letter word that communicates meaning about something, right? In the same way that this four-letter word communicates significant meaning, DNA is just a huge word that communicates something to us. And so DNA, right, it carries meaning. It's a lot like a computer code that carries this meaning, right? And when we think about DNA, right, within the nucleus of the cell, DNA is tightly wrapped into what's called a chromosome. And it's tightly wrapped around these histone proteins, but if you unravel it, right, like it's showing us here, what you see is that within the DNA, sections of it are what we call genes, and this is what gives us a protein, right? This is all the information that tells us how to make a protein. And so these DNA bases make this up, right? The DNA bases make up really the letters and the information that the DNA is telling us here. And so think about this, not even a sentence, what would we call that? It's gibberish, right? This is what comes from me late at night, working on my teaching, slamming my fingers down on my keyboard, right? This is random, blind, unguided. And this is what comes from this. Does this communicate any sort of meaning to you? No, right? But then you think about this, right? I'm sleepy, and I would love to take a nap. This was made in a completely different way, right? There's an intelligence behind this sentence. It communicates information to me. It communicates meaning to me. And so the problem is when we look at this, right, we cannot be random and coded or random and determined at the same time, right? Either it was completely random by chance, which is what we got in the first scenario, right? Or it was carefully placed, designed, and communicated some sort of meaning. And meaning can only come from some sort of intelligent source, right? Paul Davies says this. He says, can specific randomness be the guaranteed product of a deterministic, mechanical, law-like process, like a primordial soup left to the mercy of familiar laws of physics and chemistry? No, it couldn't. No known law of nature could achieve this. And yet, this is what the naturalist needs, right? We need a determined process, you know, that can create the complexity and diversity of life, and yet it needs to be completely random, right? We can't have both of these things, randomness and determination here. John Lennox, he says, it is also very easy to say evolution did it, when one has not got the faintest idea how, or has simply cobbled up a speculative just-so story with no evidential basis. Indeed, as we have seen, a materialist has to say that natural processes were solely responsible, since, in his or her book, there is no admissible alternative. As a result, it is just as easy to end up with an evolution of the gaps as with God of the gaps. And he actually goes on to talk about it's actually probably easier to end up with evolution of the gaps because no one's challenging that, right? Nobody challenges evolution, but people are very much challenging the existence and the idea of God. And so kind of beyond this, beyond the information and meaning that DNA tells us, right, which indicates that there's a mind behind the process, another huge indicator of the creator God, right, is that it's not just DNA that involves information, but our thinking contains information. And so an atheist, right, a naturalist would say, well, your brain is just an end product, right, of a mindless, unguided process. And so the question then would be, why do you trust it? Right? Why do you trust what your brain is telling you if it's a result of a mindless, unguided process? If you knew, if you went and your computer broke down, you went to the computer store, if you knew that a computer that this person was trying to sell you was a result of a totally random, unguided process, right? Maybe they just put everything in a room and let a bunch of toddlers go after it, and then we're like, here's your computer, right? They made your computer for you. Would you trust that computer? No, you would never trust a computer that was put together by chance, random, mindless, unguided processes. And yet, that is what Darwin's argument is. And there's an interesting letter that he wrote where he was thinking about this issue. And it's really the doubt of his mind that came in questioning this because he realized, man, this undermines everything about my thinking capabilities. He says, with me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. A couple other atheists have this to say. John Gray, he says, modern humanism is the faith that through science, humankind can know the truth and so be free. But if Darwin's theory of natural selection is true, this is impossible. The human mind serves evolutionary success, not truth. And we talked about this earlier, right? To be able to even do science, we're assuming, we're presupposing that our minds can tell us truth. And yet naturalism completely undermines this, right? If it's random, all by chance, unguided, it can't tell us meaning. It's just gibberish. There's nothing significant that can come from that. Thomas Nagel, in his book Mind and Cosmos, he says, evolutionary naturalism provides an account of our capacities that undermines their reliability, and in so doing, it undermines itself. His perspective is this is self-defeating, right? Because it's undermining the reliability of us even discovering that naturalism is true, right? He's like, you're basically pulling the rug out from under your own feet when you adopt this perspective here. And so information, right, it's not reducible to physics and chemistry, right? Information is not material. And so this really is such an indicator that there's a mind, right? There's an intelligence behind this trying to communicate something, right? And he has communicated something about how the natural world should work. And so in conclusion here, right, the two questions that we've asked, can I believe in both science and God? Absolutely, certainly. And where does the evidence lead us? I think there's really good case to look at all the different reasons. And that's not an exhaustive list, right? We look at seven things. There's so much more to investigate. And yet even looking at these, I think it really demands us to ask the question, man, was there a mind behind this? And I think there's good reason to believe that there was a creator mind behind all of this. If you're interested in more reading on the topic, I put some references at the end of the handout. This book is awesome. If you've never read it, I would suggest reading it. A lot of this material is taken from this book. He goes into way more depth about this, very accessible. This isn't a book. It's a YouTube video, but if you're interested in the more of the fine-tuning arguments, like a six-minute video that William Lane Craig's clan or whatever published about it, I would suggest looking at it. Signature in the Cell is a big book, but it's good. It's by Stephen Meyer. Darwin's Doubt is another really good one. We didn't even get to talk about evolution today, but if you're interested, that's a really good one about that. Also, the Cambrian Explosion kind of explores the fossil record and some of the issues around evolution.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.